Now. As I felt my arms pulled back in a decisive motion, like trussing a hog, I thought of you. It was you that I thought of. Always. It's been you.
11. Young was practicing his speech again.
I come from humble beginnings.
He looked at his notepad.
Like so many of you.
His gaze traveled to a point over me, landing on the wall behind the couch.
Many, obstacles were met.
Wait.
I leaned forward. He stood before me in a pair of boxer shorts and a white undershirt.
It sounds a little braggy.
But how can I be bragging if I say I grew up poor?
That's the thing. You didn't.
Sure I did. We lived in an apartment. One bedroom for three people.
But you always had enough to eat. You were a city person, and you could go to school wherever you wanted.
This is the Fuzhou Business Leaders Forum Awards. Everyone makes speeches about being from humble beginnings.
Seeing him there in his underpants made me want to shower him with clothes. I guess it just seems dishonest.
I don't even want to give this speech. I'm no good at speeches.
Take a deep breath before you talk. I do that when I'm teaching a class. Or you can pretend you're speaking to your friends. Like you're telling me and Zhao a story. He tried again.
I come from humble beginnings.
You have to project. Talk louder.
He took it from the top. Louder this time. His words forced and exaggerated.
I come.
He swept his arm in front of him.
From humble beginnings.
My cell phone buzzed and I grabbed it. Saw a string of numbers. The kind I'd been hoping to see every time it had rung over the past month. 5 weeks had passed since you called me and I hadn't called you back. I was scared of what you would say to me. That you'd be angry. I was scared of a lot of things I hadn't been scared of before.
Hold on,
I told Young.
I have to take this. It's a business call. Keep practicing. I'll be back in a bit.
I took the phone and walked down the hall to our guest room, which we used as an office. Shut the door, locked it, and sat on the floor by the window, against the one wall that wasn't shared with the living room.
Hello?
I tried to even out the nervousness in my voice.
Hello?
Hello, Deming. I'm glad you called again.
Hello, Mama,
you said.
It's you, I whispered, delighted and anxious.
From the living room I could hear Young repeating the first lines of his speech, varying the intonations of the words.
I come from humble beginnings. I come from humble beginnings. I come from humble beginnings.
You told me you were in school. That you had a job and played guitar. Your adoptive parents had insisted on changing your name. Not only your first name, but also your last. So there was no longer any trace of me.
What the hell kind of name was Daniel Wilkinson?
I could never call you that. You told me Vivian had gone to court so that you could get taken in by a white family. But I already knew.
Deming, I said. And each time I said your name, I felt a tiny thrill. Remember the times we used to ride the subway together? That was fun.
We went to Queens and met the other mother and son and pretended they looked like us.
They did look like us, didn't they?
Sure.
You paused.
Do you remember what you told me that day?
My little Deming. Freshly returned from China. Both of us still without English.
Your stubby legs and fat cheeks and oversized winter jacket.
Gripping my hand as we crossed the street. Afraid of all those fast cars.
No.
I couldn't remember. It was so long ago. There was a knock. The doorknob jiggled. And I heard Yung say,
Polly?
I have to go,
I whispered. Then said, loudly, Thank you for your phone call. I'll call you tomorrow. I opened the door. Yung was in the hallway.
Can I run the speech by you again? I think I've got it now.
I nodded, wiping my sweaty palms on my thighs. My smile was taped onto my face.
Why'd you lock the door?
Yung was so unsuspecting. It pained me.
A phone call from a client. Aren't you cold? Let me get you some clothes.
I took a pair of his pants out of the closet, tucking a note into the pocket. On it, I had written, The award for best speech goes to you.
In class the next morning, I wished I'd followed my own advice to take a deep breath before speaking when I stopped in the middle of a sentence and couldn't remember what I wanted to say next. My students stared as I glanced at the screen behind me.
The word "thwart" glowed in English. My mind churned. The word meant nothing to me. On my way to work, I had noticed boys your age, young men scurrying with briefcases to office buildings, or dressed in jeans, balanced on construction scaffolding.
You could be one of my students.
Instead, you had been raised by strangers. You called an American woman Mom.
Someone who had never had any indecision about motherhood. Who wanted it so badly she had taken another woman's son as her own. When I thought about this, I wanted to scream. I wanted to kill someone. I was afraid that if I let myself cry, I would never stop.
A student in the front row raised her hand.
Teacher, you were talking about prepositions.
Toward is a preposition,
I said, in hope that it would spark the next sentence.
Can anyone tell me what a preposition is?
The same student raised her hand.
Prepositions work in phrases to give additional information.
She flipped through her notes.
Common English prepositions include under and after and to.
Thank you, Mindy.
I pressed a button on the projector and advanced to the next slide.
Let's review more vocabulary words.
According to the clock on the wall, it was 10:30 in the morning. In New York, it was 9:30 the night before. New York, and all of America, was taking place in the past.
As the vocabulary words flashed on the screen, I took my phone out and scrolled down to the number I had saved in my contacts list. Under your name. Deming. Your Chinese name. Your real name. Not this Daniel Wilkinson. The name I gave you.
My chest squeezed. I stepped into the hallway, called you, and left a message.
That evening, I bought a pack of cigarettes for the first time in years and chain-smoked on a bench in the park until I was dizzy.
I thought of your new voice, your new name, and wanted to talk to you more. A lump remained in my chest. A raw, welling feeling that I needed to kill.
I smoked more, then hurried home to shower, brush my teeth, and wash the smell of cigarettes out of my hair before Yung got there.
Later that week, we arranged a time to talk. An early evening when I was home alone, and I took the phone out to the balcony to wait for your call. When I had first moved in, Yung and I would sit here on humid nights and make up nicknames for the towers busting up across the city.
Silvertop. Boxy Red. Ugly Gray.
Week after week, these buildings grew upwards until their construction scaffolding was removed like post-surgery bandages, followed by a buffing and a filing and a final layer of paint. These days I could no longer recognize Silvertop and Ugly Gray from the balcony, as they'd long been absorbed into a mass of other buildings. The skyline so cluttered I couldn't tell which buildings were new and which were less new. But it was comforting to know that nothing stayed the same for too long, that each day was a new opportunity for reinvention. A person could be transformed by a fresh wardrobe or a different nickname, like the ones I gave my Speed English Now students. Kang, a sour-faced boy with orange-streaked hair, became Ken. The girl with glitter eyeliner was Mindy. I waited. At 6:35, the phone rang, and I answered before the first ring was finished.
"I called a little late,"
he said. "I'm always a little late, too."
"Is this a good time?"
I looked through the sliding glass door, into the apartment. Yong wouldn't be home for another hour, but I'd have to dress quickly for the awards banquet. "Yes, my husband is out. I'm on our balcony right now." It wasn't hard, talking to you. I told you how I had come to New York. You told me about Ridgeboro, the town where you had gone after the Bronx, and your American parents, whom you called Peter and Kay. I didn't want to know their names. It should have been me who had gone to your high school graduation, who called you on your birthday, whose house you returned to at Christmas. I should have been the one to take credit for raising you. But all you could remember was me leaving and not finding you again. You were angry. I couldn't blame you. I was angry, too. I wanted to find a way to fix it, but I didn't know how. Not without telling you about Ardsleyville. I didn't want to think about Ardsleyville. Instead, I said all the wrong things. Leon was the only person I had ever told. And though enough time had passed that it probably didn't matter, no one would find me now, or give me prison time for how I left America. It wasn't information I wanted to share. Telling Yong would ruin everything. There were still nights I would wake up thinking of the concrete floor. The styrofoam bowls of lukewarm oatmeal. I couldn't look at oatmeal now. I'd never eat it again. And the din of hundreds of women talking in different languages. I hated that Leon knew this. How fully I'd exposed myself to him. Because if he knew, then it had been real. Not a nightmare I could just write off as my imagination. Like how talking to you reminded me of the nightmare of losing you. Leon was the one who had left on purpose, not me. I didn't leave on purpose. I loved you more than anyone. You could call another lady Mama, but I was your Mama, not her. I knew I had forfeited the right to say that, but it was never going to change. There was a knock on the window, and I jumped in my chair. Saw Yong pointing at his watch. I told you I had to go. The Fuzhou Business Leaders Forum Awards dinner was in a conference hall with small windows near the ceiling. It was May. Warm outside. But inside I was shivering as Yong fidgeted next to me. On stage, a real estate tycoon was rambling about his childhood in a village north of Fuzhou, running 10 minutes past the 5-minute time limit. "I learned the lessons of hunger as a child during the famine years," the tycoon said in an oddly cheerful lilt. "When my mother would feed us a thin paste of rice and water, our stomachs growled, but we never complained." Chopsticks clinked against the insides of bowls. Metal spoons scraped against serving plates. Iba had said his family had been so poor that he and his brother had shared a single grain of rice. And I felt annoyed listening to the tycoon claim the same. He was rumored to never eat leftovers or use a towel more than once. His servants whisking away his bath linens immediately after he used them. The excess food disappearing as if it had never existed. I wanted to duck into the bathroom and call you. Share the absurdity. Between speakers, I tried to pay attention to the conversations around me. Liu Jin and Zhao wanted to buy a small country home in the mountains, while Dai Lang said he'd prefer one by the sea. I said I preferred ocean to mountains. I told the couple next to me about our kitchen renovations. Gave them the names of the workers Yong and I had used. Good craftsmanship, I said, comforted by my city accent, the confident way I talked. These were characteristics of Fuzhou's Polly, not the Polly who had lived in New York and wore $5 jeans and used the same soap to wash her face and body, who let her son watch TV all day. Hong Kong will be our next vacation destination, Yong told Ning and Zai Lang. And after that, Singapore and Tokyo.
Tokyo?
Zai Lang said.
Have you booked the tickets yet?
I haven't gotten around to it, Yong said.
Work is so busy.
But perhaps a winter trip to Hong Kong.
It's so easy to get there.
What do you think, Polly?
Sure.
I took a second helping of broccoli, but could barely taste the food.
Wonderful!
Let me know when you go, and I'll send you a list of my favorite restaurants, Ning said.
That sounds great. Tell me more about what it's like there.
But as I watched Ning's mouth move, I was unable to concentrate on the words. Tomorrow, I would call and let you know I hadn't meant to end our call so abruptly. Our table was full of our friends, Zhao and Lu Jin, Ning and Zai Lang, and Yong's other colleagues and their wives. I looked around the room and saw the same table duplicated, over and over. Fat men in dark suits, lipsticked women in tight dresses, plates and plates of food, empty beer bottles. I didn't look out of place. My purple dress had been tailored to fit, and I wore a pair of diamond earrings and a matching ring. A gold bracelet with oval loops that resembled a chain. My hair had been dyed and highlighted. Earlier tonight, after I got off the phone with you and changed into my dress, Yong and I had admired our reflections in the bedroom mirror.
Look how we match, I said.
I couldn't tell him about you or Artsleyville. Destroy the illusion we built for ourselves. Another round of dishes arrived, and the forum's president, a man in a pinstripe suit, introduced Yong, who made his way to the stage. He tapped the microphone to make sure it was on, even though it had been working fine when the president had spoken.
I come from humble beginnings, he said, like so many of you. I met many obstacles and challenges along the way, but overcame them through perseverance. And now, I am proud to lead Yongtex. We are truly the future of business, because we're not only a factory, but we work for the social good. First, by providing job opportunities to the needy.
He looked down at his notes and up at the crowd. I silently pleaded for him to keep talking.
And second, we promote trade. Third, we are spurring economic development in the region and elevating the status of Fuzhou business.
His words petered out, but he finished strong. Our table clapped, followed by the rest of the room.
Thank you,
Yong said. When he returned to the table, I could see how relieved he was. I placed a hand on his knee. We needed each other. I belonged here.
You did good, I said.
After the dinner, we had coffee at Ning and Xilong's apartment. The women sat along the end of an L-shaped sectional couch, the men at the long dining table. Ning and Xilong had blocked off part of the living room and constructed a new wall to create a bedroom for their son, Philip. Lu Jin and Zhao's daughter was taking grade 9 English, even though she was only in grade 8.
She was falling behind, so we decided to push the teacher to place her in a higher class, Lu Jin said. That's what you have to do. Force them to do better.
Children don't function that way, I said. They also need encouragement. Ning smiled.
You have to encourage, but you also have to be firm. They need to learn on their own.
But what are we telling our children if we set them up for failure? I saw Ning exchange a look with Lu Jin. We could be harming them, affecting them later in life.
On those TV shows, the parents are always giving their children empty praise,
Lu Jin said.
But real life is different.
I am talking about real life, I said.
Real-life children aren't like the ones you see on television.
I'm not talking about television. What, I can't have an opinion on raising children, too? Lu Jin raised her eyebrows. Ning stood up and pulled down the front of her dress.
Excuse me, I need to check on Philip.
It's his bedtime and I bet he's still up. The room felt airless. The weather has been so warm lately, I said to Lu Jin.
I hear it will rain tomorrow, she said. What a relief that will be.
I went to the kitchen and rinsed out my coffee cup. I wanted you to call again. But you were right. I had messed up. I had given up on finding you so that I could sit at parties with people like this. Keeping you a secret. As if you were the thing that was wrong.
I dried my hands on a towel that hung from a hook on the side of the refrigerator, and the cloth snagged on the bracelet Yong bought me last year. When I pulled the towel away, the bracelet seemed too large and gaudy for my wrist, like the chain was mocking me. In the living room, Zhao was talking about Sichuanese migrant workers, his favorite topic.
That's why we pay tuition to send our daughter to a private international school. The public schools are overrun with outsiders.
I sat across from him and said, But they can't even get into state schools.
Exactly, and they should stay out.
They have schools in the countryside they can go to, Lu Jin said.
You just said they're taking over the public schools in the city, and then you said they can't get into these schools. What are you saying? You can't have it both ways.
Zhao scoffed.
Public, private, what's the difference? The bottom line is, they don't belong here.
Yong shifted in his chair. But you hire them, I said. To do your renovations, paint your apartment, work in your factory. You're contradicting yourself. When I saw Yong's smile fade, I kept talking, trying to drown out Zhao and Lu Jin, until Ning came back and changed the subject. I hadn't given you up to agree with such hateful things. I was a good person. I am a good person.
That's why you can't see anything. It's because of those damn sunglasses.
Getting into our apartment, Yong had banged his knee against the door. Sometimes his dark lenses made him look sleek, even a little dangerous. But at other times, like tonight, they seemed desperate.
I'm glad it's over,
he said.
The speech, the dinner, the whole thing.
He looked tired. I decided to be kind. People loved your speech.
See, I told you it was what they wanted to hear.
Tomorrow was Saturday, and Yong didn't have to go to work until after lunch. We could sleep in, have sex. I washed my face and brushed my teeth, checked to make sure the door was locked and the lights were off in the living room. We'd skip watching TV tonight. I thought Yong had fallen asleep, but as I got into bed, he spoke up.
So, who's dumbing?
I shut the light off so he wouldn't see the alarm on my face.
Who?
Your phone rang when you were in the bathroom. It said, dumbing.
My phone was lying face up on the night table. The screen displayed a missed call from you. A new voicemail message. I would listen to it later. When Yong was asleep. I spoke at the ceiling.
Dumbing is one of Bus Cheng's shaman clients. He's traveling abroad right now, calling at odd hours. He must have forgot the time difference.
Okay,
Yong said. He didn't sound convinced. I pulled the sheets over my shoulders. Good night. A minute later, Yong spoke again. His voice sounded far away, even if he was next to me.
When I came home earlier tonight, you were out on the balcony, on the phone. As soon as you saw me, you ended the call. You were acting strange.
I was glad he couldn't see my flushed cheeks or hear my rapidly beating heart.
Are you accusing me of something?
No.
I haven't done anything wrong. You have nothing to worry about.
I'm not worried. But you seemed upset with Zhao.
I can't stand it when he talks about migrant workers that way. Why don't you ever say anything? Yongtex has your name. You got the award tonight. Tell him to shut up. Once and for all.
I just don't let it bother me.
Could we go to Hong Kong instead of talking about it?
After the holiday season. There's a lot going on at work.
That's more than 6 months away.
Not so long, right?
I'm tired of these parties. Don't you get tired of it, too?
I don't mind.
Yong didn't fight me. He wasn't angry. Again, I felt let down. I imagined leaving him, or being left, losing this companionship, the comfort of being with someone you knew so well. I thought of the nights I had lain awake at Arnsleyville and in the workers' dormitory, even in the bunk on Rutgers Street, and how long they'd been, how endless the days. All I'd wanted then was to not feel alone. Last year, when Yong had been away for 3 weeks on business, I'd been glad to have the apartment to myself. Didn't pick up my clothes or clean the dishes or take out the trash. But when I came home from work, the apartment felt empty. And when I finally slept, I would dream about you. A 10-year-old reciting New York City subway lines. Then wake up unsure of where I was. Expecting to see you across the room. Yong touched my arm.
I did good tonight, didn't I?
You did great. I knew that I should wait. Hold off on telling Yong the truth and on calling you until I was stronger. I didn't want to upset you more. Yiba believed that to give in to your cravings was a sign of weakness. Be strong, I told myself, though I wasn't sure what that meant anymore.
Think it over before you say anything. But I couldn't stop myself. I have a son and I lost him. The words hung in the air for an awful, extended moment.
A son?
I couldn't answer.
What do you mean, lost?
I had him when I was 19. Got pregnant by my neighbor in the village. I left him in America because I couldn't take him back to China with me, and then he was adopted by an American family. He recently got in touch with me. That's who Deming is. That's his name. Deming Guo. I wanted to say it again. So I did. Deming Guo.
Your name echoed in the bedroom. Yong took his hand off my arm.
He lives in New York now, and he just found me. We spoke on the phone twice.
Yong shook his head, as if he was trying to clear water out of his ears. I looked at my husband and tried to will him to look back at me. Years ago, as a student in my class, his English had been clumsy, halting. In Chinese he could talk and talk, but in English he was nearly mute. And I had felt like I was somehow responsible.
You left your son?
It's not like that.
I don't understand.
I was deported, okay? That's why I left America.
Why are you telling me this now?
I didn't want you to worry.
I can't believe you didn't tell me before.
I can explain.
He didn't respond.
Are you mad at me?
He wasn't mad. He didn't yell.
Or leave the room.
Or ask me to leave. Instead, he let me rest against him. He leaned into me. He took my hand and held it close. But hadn't I always known he would do this? He had never been the yelling type. In the moment before I told him about you, I had imagined I was ready to be left. To hear the slamming door, feel my anticipated punishment. That was the reason I'd kept you a secret for so long. Why I had given up looking. But Yong was staying. And I would stay too. In the end, what surprised me the most was my relief.
12. Roland's roommate Adrian had been home for days. Dumped by his girlfriend, he was no longer moving in with her at the end of May, and now Daniel had to wait for Adrian to finish taking a shower before he could get to the bathroom, which was 200% hairier, the guy being both bearded and long-haired, a shag carpet of a man. Adrian was as silent as Roland was talkative, lumbering out of his room each day with a towel wrapped around his waist and greeting Daniel on the couch with a single, "Hey." On the morning of May 13, 2 days before the big show, Roland couldn't stop talking about who had RSVP'd and who hadn't, changing the set list for the 20th time. Later tonight, they would run through the songs again. As Adrian entered minute 15 of a marathon shower, Daniel brushed his teeth in the kitchen sink.
30% chance of rain today,
Roland said, pacing the living room.
Think it'll make a difference in the turnout? People don't want to go out in the rain. Though what's wrong with them? Are they allergic to life? But there's also the humidity factor, since it's a new space to us, and that could affect the sound.
Daniel rinsed his mouth and spat. If he didn't leave the apartment in the next 5 minutes, he was going to be very late for work. He heard his phone ringing and dashed across the room to find it, knowing it wouldn't be his mother, yet hoping it would be. A week had passed since they had last spoken, and yesterday, tired of waiting for her to get in touch with him. He had called and left a message telling her to not bother calling him again. And she hadn't. He'd beat her to it. It was Kay. He let it go to voicemail. And as he searched for a matching pair of socks, he listened to her message, reminding him about the meeting with the Carlo Dean, the day after tomorrow.
"Bad news,"
Roland said. Daniel found the missing sock.
"I might have to go upstate the day after tomorrow. For a meeting." "You're fucking with me, right? We have a show on Friday."
Daniel poked through a lump of t-shirts and towels and found his right shoe, but not his left.
"A meeting with the dean of Carlo College." "You don't want to go to Carlo College."
He pulled on the right shoe and laced it, hobbled around with his left foot in a sock.
"Maybe I do." "Who's going to play the show with me, then?"
"Get Javi to do it. I don't know. The guitar parts are easy."
"Easy?"
Roland mind tearing his hair out.
"Make up your mind for once. You've been here for, what, 5 months? And you haven't gotten a better job, so you still can't afford to rent your own room."
"I thought Adrian was moving out. I was going to take his room." Daniel turned to face Roland.
"Do you want me to leave?" "That's not the point. The point is that you're never going to get anywhere if you keep on doing what your parents want. You don't even know what you want. You don't think you deserve better. Don't psychoanalyze me and don't tell me what to do."
Daniel found his left shoe under the couch. In the bathroom, the shower shut off. Adrian crooning Christmas carols. Roland looked disgusted.
"You know what? Don't bother coming to rehearsal tonight. Come on! I've got to go to work."
Daniel opened the door, still holding the shoe. He'd put it on in the hallway. Right now, he needed to get out of the apartment. 8 hours of burrito making produced little relief.
"I'm going to your show Friday,"
Evan said, as they sliced bell peppers.
"We used to have raves in Gowanus back in the day. These warehouse ragers. Now it's all gentrified and ruined."
His co-workers Purvy and Kevin were going too. All afternoon, Daniel's phone buzzed with messages. Of course he'd play the show. Of course he wasn't going to Carlo. When he left Tres Locos, it was after 7. He went back to the apartment to get his strat, rode the train out to Bushwick, ran up the block to the building and took the rickety service elevator to the 7th floor. Outside the metal door, he heard a Psychic Heart song playing. Thought Javi might be at the rehearsal too. But when he pushed the door open, he saw Nate, strumming a guitar as Roland sang and pressed buttons on a sequencer. Nate's floppy hair bounced as he bobbed to the beat. He was hitting the right chords, but the song sounded even flatter than it already was. Nate and Roland saw Daniel and exchanged a look. The song stopped.
"What's going on?"
Daniel said.
"We're getting a second guitarist?" "You're out and I'm in,"
Nate said.
"That's what's going on."
Roland walked over and said, his voice lowered,
"I can't have a band with someone who isn't reliable." "I'm going to play the show tomorrow."
Roland shook his head.
"You'll change your mind again." "I won't, I swear. I'm not going to Carlo."
"Too late,"
Nate sang in a falsetto. Roland glared at Nate, then walked Daniel out the door and started to close it.
"Sorry."
It took less than 10 minutes to scoop up his things from Roland's living room and shove them into his backpack. He left the strap behind and grabbed his acoustic, walked up Lafayette, past the poker club, and turned onto Broadway. He put on his headphones and inched the volume up, let the music make the world louder. A glorious reverb of lights popping on like candy-coated solar flares as he listened to Bowie and Freddie Mercury's voices bursting out in Under Pressure.
"Why can't we? Give love! Give love! Give love! Give love!"
Without music, the world was flattened. Washed out. Too obvious. Daniel cranked the volume up even more, until he was awash in colors and sound, and there were only lights and possibility and flying. The way it was when the guitar was translating his brain. He walked through Union Square, through the Flatiron, past people eating outside restaurants, a group of skateboarding teenagers, tourists clutching subway maps, laughing couples. Herald Square. Chain stores. Times Square. More tourists. At Columbus Circle, he sank onto a bench and put his guitar case down. He'd blown it. He spent the night sipping watery coffee in a diner booth, typing angry texts to Roland and deleting them before sending. He sent a text to Angel saying, "Hi, hope you're well." He texted her every few days, but she never wrote back. Port Authority wasn't far away. He could buy a bus ticket and be in Ridgeboro in a couple hours. But Roland's accusations had stuck with him. He didn't know what he wanted, and he didn't know how to figure it out. In the morning, he took the N train out to Sunset Park, had a bowl of pho at a Vietnamese spot, killed a few more hours in a cafe, then headed to the only people he knew in the city who might let him stay with them. Vivian was on her porch, watering a planter of yellow and red flowers.
"Deming?"
She eyed his bag and guitar case. "Hi, Vivian." Her eyes were shadowed by a lime-green visor with "Virginia Beach" printed across the top. And Daniel couldn't read her expression.
"Is Michael here?"
"He's at school right now," Vivian said in Fujianese. "He'll be back later. You want to come in?"
"I need somewhere to stay. For today. Tonight."
"Okay. Put your bag in the living room."
This was how he ended up cooking with Vivian. Timothy and Michael would both be home by dinner, she said. Daniel looked at the clock on the wall. It was just past 2. Dinner was a long time away. He chopped garlic and ginger on a cutting board, seated at a wooden table, as Vivian browned chunks of beef. On the table was a stack of mail, flyers for local businesses, printed in English and Chinese, the one on top advertising an immigration lawyer with an office on 8th Avenue, the accompanying photo of a woman with aggressively airbrushed teeth. This was what his life would have been if he had remained Deming Guo, if his mother and Leon had stayed together. They would all be having regular family dinners with Vivian and Timothy.
"Leon said he spoke to you,"
Vivian said, as the meat sizzled.
"He said he was happy to hear from you."
"He gave me my mother's phone number."
When Vivian didn't say anything discouraging about his Chinese, he decided to press on, taking the time to remember and choose the right words.
"I called her. I spoke to her."
He told Vivian about how his mother had remarried but hadn't told her husband about him.
"I still don't know where she went after she left New York. If she went to Florida."
Vivian flipped the pieces of meat with a pair of metal tongs, then removed them onto a plate lined with a paper towel.
"I don't think so. Here, give me those."
Daniel gave her the cutting board, and she slid the garlic and ginger into the pot with the edge of the knife, and stirred them with a wooden spoon. The room grew fragrant.
"But why did she end up in China, then?"
"I don't know. But she wouldn't have left without you.
You were all she could talk about. All the time."
She returned the cutting board to him, now piled with carrots. "Chop these into small pieces." She put the beef back into the pot, filled it with water, clapped a lid on top.
"We would talk about the plans we had for you and Michael. She'd be smoking."
Vivian mimed taking a cigarette from her lips and holding it out with her elbow,
gaze to the side, like his mother used to do. Always smoking. And she had that big old voice. And we'd have these giant mugs of tea in front of us in that little kitchen. We'd say Michael was going to become a doctor and you were going to work on TV.
TV? She saw you working with the sound on TV or movies. Because you liked music. And TV. We weren't so wrong, were we?
You were pretty close.
Daniel sawed away at the carrots. An orange disc flew off the cutting board. He got up, hunted for it at the other end of the table.
Here, Vivian said, taking the knife from him. Cut like this.
He angled it the way she showed him, slicing the carrots more loosely. She checked on the soup, adding salt and pepper.
There was that nail salon. You remember the name?
Hello, Gorgeous.
He'd looked it up, too, but it was no longer there.
You remember your mother's friend there? Woman with a high baby voice.
Dee Dee.
Right, Dee Dee. So after your mother disappeared, Dee Dee called Leon. Turned out someone ratted their boss out to ICE. Immigration. They came and arrested a lot of people at the salon. Your mother was supposed to be at work that day.
He could remember overhearing Vivian and Leon talking about Dee Dee. A lawyer. But not this.
Nobody ever told me anything.
It happened to a woman I knew who worked in a restaurant. Someone crosses the wrong person, makes a call to ICE, and they come take the workers away.
Take them where?
Deport them. Or they have these camps, these jails, for immigrants. We always heard rumors about them. I knew a lady whose husband had been sent to one, though. He went out driving to the grocery store and never came home. She found out he was in a jail in Arizona or someplace like that. And then he was on a plane back to their country. Somewhere in Central America.
Vivian shook her head.
So your mother's friend Dee Dee figured out the restaurant in Florida where that job was and called them. They said your mother was buying a ticket for Florida but never showed up. But Dee Dee and Leon called ICE and they said she wasn't there either.
She bought a bus ticket to Florida. But had told them they weren't moving.
It made no sense.
So she wasn't in jail? I always thought it was another man. Though she was going to marry Leon.
I don't know.
Vivian picked up the junk mail and tossed the flyers into a plastic bin.
We waited and waited for her. You remember? All those months. I would have paid off her debt if I knew she was coming back. I wouldn't have given you away.
Had his mother been in jail while he was listening to records in Ridgeboro? When he and Angel had taken the cab to the old apartment? But she'd also known about his adoption? Daniel put the knife down. He had once stood with his mother and Leon on the Staten Island ferry. Both of them with their arms around him, their love sure and shining. The kind of gesture Kay and Peter tried to offer up, but he could never bring himself to fully accept. He had lost so much. And he was lost. The distance between them then and now felt enormous. Now he was nervous that Michael and Timothy's arrival home would puncture the unexpected calm he had felt. Being alone with Vivian all day. But when Michael did come home, after Daniel had taken a shower and a long nap, Daniel's dread disappeared. It felt good to be with people who didn't know him as a fuck-up. After dinner, after his second helping of soup, then a third, Michael said,
"Want to play pool? There's a place in Bay Ridge."
At the pool hall they got beers and played eight ball. Daniel made the break and called solids.
I spoke to my mom again,
by the way. Your mom thinks maybe she got caught up in an immigration raid and thrown in jail and deported, and that's why she ended up in China. Damn. Did you ask her about it when you talked to her? I didn't have the guts. She didn't seem to want to talk about it.
He aimed for a side pocket and missed.
Thanks, though. You helped me get in touch with her.
Yeah, of course, of course. So are you going to talk to her again?
We'll see.
Michael leaned onto the table and into his cue stick.
12 to the 10. Corner pocket.
He made the shot.
You're good,
Daniel said.
Where'd you learn to play like that?
I play a lot with my friends.
Some of them like to bet, but I don't.
Hey, remember that research assistant job I was telling you about?
I turned the application in.
I decided to go with the project I wanted to do. The riskier one.
Guess I have you to thank.
There were video games across the room, but Daniel didn't see video poker.
What did I do?
You inspired me.
I don't know anything about science.
I mean, you're doing music. You're in this amazing band. You're living with your friends in the city.
I can't even afford to move out of my parents' apartment unless I get this grant.
I have to commute 3 hours to school and back, and my mom grills the hell out of me if I stay out late.
Instead of doing the safe thing, you're, like, free.
After Michael knocked down 4 balls in 1 round, Daniel managed to drop a solid ball.
I'm not an inspiration. I got kicked out of the band. I owe my friend $10,000 and she won't talk to me anymore. I got kicked out of school.
You did? Why?
You know how you said some of your friends like to bet? I guess I do too.
Daniel finished his beer. He told Michael about the poker. The expulsion.
Shit,
Michael said.
I'm sorry that happened to you.
I kind of wanted to leave anyway.
Are you going back?
My parents want me to transfer to the school where they teach. Upstate.
Do you want to go there?
The kindness in Michael's question gave Daniel deja vu.
No. Though sometimes it seems like I don't have a choice.
Michael adjusted his watch band.
I remember what you were like after your mother left. You thought she left because of you. You blamed yourself. I was a kid. I didn't know what was going on. I know it was a long time ago.
Michael laughed a little.
But I just want you to be okay. And if you're not okay, I guess that's fine too. I am okay.
As he said it, he knew it was true.
I miss her,
Michael said.
Your mother. She was always real nice to me.
He picked up his cue and studied the table.
8 ball, side pocket.
Daniel leaned against the edge, trying to distract Michael from scoring the winning shot. But Michael sank the ball and Daniel whooped, high-fiving him. The apartment was quiet. Everyone asleep except Daniel, who was on the living room couch. He looked at a picture of Michael in a cap and gown at his high school graduation, framed and hung on the wall over the television, along with a large department store studio portrait of Vivian, Michael, and Timothy posing against a blue backdrop. Peter and Kay had one like it in their living room, with Daniel in the middle, taken several Christmases ago at the JCPenney's at the Little Town Mall. They had a framed picture of him from his high school graduation, too. On the bottom shelf of a cabinet below the TV, Daniel found a row of photo albums. He removed one and flipped through the pages, saw pictures of Vivian and Timothy's wedding, faded portraits of people he didn't know, a younger Timothy with a full head of hair. He knew there wouldn't be any photos with himself in them, but he kept looking. Album after album. As if the next page would be the one where he would finally see the Ming. Part 3. Tilt. 13.
If we plot the supply curve and the demand curve on the same graph, we see that, in an efficient market, they intersect at an equilibrium price and quantity.
Professor Nichols pressed a button and the PowerPoint advanced, displaying a black and white graph. 50 students sat at long tables arranged bleacher style up the back of Peterson Hall, most studying their laptops. Multiple chat windows dotting their screens like hungry mosquitoes. One woman in the back had headphones on, not bothering to hide her laughter as she watched a movie on her tablet.
"We call this P and Q, respectively,"
Professor Nichols said, twisting the end of his gray ponytail. Daniel Wilkinson sat in the next-to-last row, to the right of Amber Bitburger, watching the guy in front of him play online poker. The guy's neck was pink. His back was set in a hard line. He kept betting too much on terrible hands and losing, and Daniel couldn't look away. The software that prevented him from playing was still installed on his laptop, and he hadn't seen a game in months. Unable to stand it a moment longer, the guy's back was so close he could almost touch it. He leaned until he was halfway over the table. The guy was wearing headphones, but Daniel could hear the exact sound the cards made as they shuffled. A decisive, brassy bronze. He leaned closer. "Hey," he whispered. Amber glanced over. "Don't do it," Daniel said, as the guy's finger hovered over the bet button on an 8 of clubs and a 3 of hearts. "Damn it," Daniel said out loud, as the guy clicked. The guy twisted around, his ears reddening. "What the fuck?" he hissed. Professor Nichols said,
"Gentlemen, is there a problem up there?"
Daniel slumped down. Amber looked at him and mouthed, "What was that about?" After 4 months in New York City, Ridgeboro seemed smaller, shabbier, and more remote. The teenagers in the Dunkin' Donuts appeared younger than he'd looked when he was their age, and the Food Lion, with its wide, empty aisles and piped-in light oldies music, evoked gloom. There were so many cereals, so many brands of toothpaste, and yet so few people. You could practically see tumbleweeds rolling down the floor past the sodas and chips. Summer session was a 4-month semester crammed into 6 weeks. He was in classes weekdays from 9 to 5. "Good training for the working world," Kay said. Mornings, Daniel felt like he'd been dug out of the ground and had to relearn how to walk. He would fall asleep in class, jerk awake, obsess about psychic hearts and the acclaim Nate was receiving that was supposed to be his. On May 15, he had left the city at dawn, arriving in Ridgeboro in time to meet with the dean. That night, as Nate and Roland played for Hutch and Daniel's co-workers, Daniel had apologized to Peter and Kay.
"We can't take you seriously until you take yourself seriously," Peter said.
Kay had been able to get him into 2 classes, in her and Peter's departments. Comparative Politics and Microeconomics 101. 8 hours of daily lectures felt isolating, and Daniel felt aggrieved, but also committed, superior. It was good for him, like going to the dentist or holding the door for a slow-walking stranger when you were in a rush. After econ, Amber Bitburger, whom he used to sit behind in Mrs. Lumpkin's 6th-grade class, walked out with him into the full heat of a June afternoon. The onslaught of sunlight made his eyes sting after a long morning inside the windowless lecture hall, where the air conditioning always seemed to be set to 55 degrees. He removed his sweatshirt, and,
in a green Melancholia Records t-shirt with a picture of a cantaloupe on a turntable, bared his arms for the walk across the quad.